Hey guys, welcome to the Physio Plus Fitness podcast with me, Chris Lendrum, and Glenn Robbins on the line. Today we've got Steph Philbay, who is a researcher. And the thing that we really want to chat to her about today is ACLs, which she was a lead author on one of the recent articles about the cross bracing protocol and how that can help with healing of ACLs. And we're going to talk to her about that research and hopefully, if she doesn't mind, some ACL questions and chats in general. So first of all, Steph, welcome to the podcast and thank you for coming on.
Thanks for the invitation.
So in terms of the, I wanted to sort of start with a bit of maybe background stuff. So obviously that paper that you did was looking at the cross bracing protocol in particular and whether that facilitated healing of the ACL. So what were your thoughts and what does the research say really around ACL healing in general? So can it heal? How, you know, much does it heal, et cetera?
Yeah, so I'm a physio myself and, you know, during my undergrad degree, I was taught that ACLs can't heal. Not sure if you were both taught that as well. Yeah, so it's an assumption that's really been around for a long time and that's kind of informed current treatment for ACL injury, which in the UK and Australia is ACL surgery for most people. So when I looked into the literature around ACL healing, I was so surprised to see how few studies have actually looked at it. There is a systematic review out there looking at ACL healing, but it found most of the research available was of low quality and small sample sizes. But it did suggest in various rates that yes, ACLs can heal. So we designed a study around the Canoon RCT, which was published earlier this year in BJSM. Are you familiar with that Canoon trial? Or?
Yeah.
So they randomized people to early ACL reconstruction or initial management with rehab only. And so we went and looked at the MRIs that they have from that study and graded the MRIs for signs of ACL healing. So everyone had a ruptured ACL at baseline and they were randomized to one of those two treatment options. And surprisingly, on two-year MRI, we found that 30% of people who were randomized to initial rehab actually had a healed ACL on two-year MRI. And those with healing on two-year MRI actually reported better outcomes than those with non-healing and better outcomes than those randomized to ACL reconstruction. And so I think that study leads really nicely into this work around the cross bracing protocol. So if we keep that sort of 30% figure in mind, in terms of people randomly allocated to initial rehab, our preliminary data from the cross-bracing protocol is really promising. So using that same criteria of healing, 90% had signs of healing after the bracing protocol, and that's only 3 months after ACL injury.
Wow.
Yeah. So now we've now managed around about 400 people in clinical practice led by Tom Cross. So that paper published in BJSM was reporting data from the first 80, and we're now analysing data from quite a lot more patients that have gone through that pathway.
And does it look similar in terms of the outcomes?
Yes. Because it's a pragmatic cohort, so the data was collected in clinical practice. So it has, since that first 80, evolved somewhat in terms of the decision-making and the advice given to patients. So because of that, the percentage with healings now increased above 90%. Okay. We're likely going to find around 95% healing rate. But, you know, in Tom's clinical practice, he's become a bit more selective in terms of learning from experience of what we can see on baseline MRI in terms of the nature of the rupture and who might be most likely to have a really positive healing outcome based on that MRI.
And just for people that haven't read the paper, so what is the bracing protocol? What does it consist of?
Yeah, so I'll take you back to the initial idea for the bracing protocol, which was Merv Cross. So this is Tom Cross's father, who's a very experienced orthopedic surgeon. So they were treating a patient who really didn't want surgery, and they said, you know, there's got to be another way. And Merv came up with the idea of bracing in 90 degrees flexion. And the reason for that was that there's anatomical studies showing that that's when the origin and insertion of the ACL are in closest proximity. So it minimizes that distance between the two ruptured ends of the ACL. And so following the orthopedic principles of, you know, reduction, fixation, similarly how we'd treat a bone fracture, you know, we'd reduce the fracture and then we'd hold it in that position to allow healing to occur. So it follows those principles and it involves the patient wearing a knee brace, fixed at 90 degrees flexion for the first 4 weeks. Then from that point onwards, at weekly increments, it increases in terms of the knee range allowed in the brace until full range of motion at 10 weeks and the brace is removed at 12 weeks. So physios always ask, you know, are these people immobile during that time? They're actually performing quite intense physio-supervised rehab. So within the available range, the entire time. So we're getting people active and using their muscles as much as they can during those 12 weeks. But then once the brace is removed, they'll progress to a goal-orientated, a progressive, you know, quality-based rehab until the point of return to sport.
Cool. Yeah, I noticed that on the paper, and I just wondered what things they were when they were fixed at 90 or obviously, you know, increasing in terms of 100, 110, etc. What specifically, physio-wise, like exercises, what sorts of things are they doing in that time when they are braced at that fixed position?
Yeah, so isometric quads and hamstrings contractions, neuromuscular e-stims in a lot of cases, not everyone, but in a lot of cases. And you can be a bit creative in terms of the exercises. So do allow weight bearing through the leg if you can safely get into that position. So for some, they could get into, you know, the bridge position and do some isometric holds and things in that position as well. But during those initial 4 weeks, it's obviously fairly limited in what you can do for the ACL injured knee, but they're working their other side, upper limb, still working cardiovascular function and doing as much as they can during that time. And then as that knee range increases, the available exercises increase as well in terms of what they can do within that available range.
Yeah, that was something that jumped out at me. I was thinking that would be a great opportunity for muscle stim. Like you could use that in that 4 week period on the quads and hammies and get them going with that. How are they coping with that first 4 weeks when they're in that position? How are they reporting that back to the researchers? It seems like quite a difficult position to maintain for 4 weeks. Have they got specific frames that they're using or specific?
Yeah, so it is challenging. So we've done a qualitative study to really understand the patient's experiences as well. And a common narrative was that first four weeks is challenging, but worthwhile in the end. Mm. So some people were quite creative about the ways in which they adapted to wearing the brace and some of the exercises and things they did and swimming and whatnot whilst braced at 90 degrees. So crutches is probably the most common mobility aid used, but other people use like a knee scooter, which you can get around a lot faster. One person opted to use a wheelchair because they had one available and wanted to get around that way. So there are some other ways you can mobilize whilst fixed at 90. In terms of the experience, I guess we need to consider what the comparison is, which is, let's say, ACL reconstruction for most people. I think we discussed before the podcast that we all had an ACL surgery here ourselves. So we know what that first 4 weeks is like. I don't know what it was like for you guys, but it's a lot of lying in bed on heavy painkillers and not a lot of knee motion or movement going on. And it can be quite challenging that first 4 weeks post-surgery as well.
So sure.
I think both treatment pathways have their challenges. And actually, we're getting now data on a really novel group of patients. So over 60 patients have had ACL reconstruction on their opposite knee before undergoing the bracing protocol on their other knee. So that's a really insightful group of patients to explore because they can compare both treatment pathways, compare the challenges, the pros and cons of each, and they can also compare how their knee feels, you know, one with a graft, another in most cases having healed naturally. So I think that's really interesting as well.
When will that be coming out, the results from there? Because that is fascinating, I think, to have that group where they can compare one for the other.
Yeah, so we do have a number of patients within the first qualitative study of that description, but I think we want to design a standalone study because it is such an interesting group. That's in the works. We've got quite a lot of research going on, so I have to hold tight for that one, I think.
Watch this space. And then, one of the questions I had was around outcomes, because obviously the studies, I mean, it's amazing in terms of that over 90% of healing. But what do you know about how that translates over into function? Because obviously healing's great, but then it's the question becomes, does that healing mean that someone is more stable and functionally better off? So are they, you know, are they going on, are these patients needing to go on to have ACL repairs? Because I know in the Canon study, there was a delayed ACL and a lot of patients kind of opted for that delayed ACL. They had conservative first, and then I think it's quite a large number of them actually ended up having the ACL op. So I guess the fear of some people might be, okay, I'm going to go through this rehab. Obviously, it might be quite uncomfortable for the first 4 weeks, and then I might end up having to have it anyway. So there's that fear maybe around that side of things. So what is there any data on that, Steph, at all, in terms of
outcomes? Yeah, so I guess where to begin is firstly around the definition of healing, because it is more complex than just healing in terms of how do you define healing, and then how do you define the different quality or potentially different types of healing, if you will. So for the Canoe trial, for both studies, but because of the Canoe trial, we used a criteria that involved continuity of the ACL. So as long as those fibers were continuous from origin to insertion, then we'd call that some evidence of ACL healing. But within that group, you've got different grades. So we split that into using an ACLOAS, like a previous published criteria. So grade zero would be a normal appearing ACL as if it wasn't injured at all. A grade one is continuous, but it may be a bit thicker than a normal ACL, or it may still have an increased signal in MRI. And then a grade two is continuous, but it could actually be a bit thinner than a normal ACL, or it could be a little bit elongated or presenting with a bit of a sag. So it's likely that grade one and two function a little bit differently most of the time. So what we're seeing is a grade zero or one appears, based on the data, to typically function as an uninjured ACL. These people are functioning really well. So in the grade, those were the grade one, and this was just at 3 months after injury in the cross-bracing protocol, 92% had returned to sport by 12 months, which is a really high return to sport rate. Everyone had a normal Lockman test compared to their other knee, and their patient-reported function was excellent. It was, from memory, a median 98 out of 100 points. So they appear to be functioning really well. Then in that grade two group, so where it could be a bit thinner or it may be elongated, that's a little bit more of a mixed bag. So some of those people will function really well, but others don't function well enough and would be recommended surgery. When we take that average for that grade two group, it typically appears fairly comparable with ACL surgical data, which isn't overly surprising because post-surgery, some people do really well and other people do poor. So, you know, the data that we're seeing for that grade two group, again, in the bracing protocol, 62% had returned to sport with a grade two heel. That's more similar to what we see post-surgery, where 55% returned to competitive sport. So we need to be a bit careful for several reasons. Firstly, you know, not all healing is necessarily the same. But secondly, even though it's not the best possible heal as it appears on a three-month MRI, it could still be better or comparable to ACL surgery. So we don't know that yet. So we do need to be cautious not to be too fixated on it being a perfect appearance on MRI, because we need a lot more information about how that then relates to function. My other comment will be what we learned from the Canoe trial. Why that was really interesting is because the patients were kind of blinded, right, to their healing status. It wasn't something that was actually looked at in clinical practice. We went in the future and looked back on the MRIs. So those patient-reported outcomes, which was quality of life, their ability for the knee to function during sport activities and pain and symptoms, they were better in people with ACL healing compared to people with surgery, but they weren't aware that they had ACL healing. So I think that's a really interesting outcome, and it does really give merit to the association between better function and what it is that we're seeing on MRI.
Mm. And what sort of factors would influence a good healing versus a not so good healing, in your opinion, based on the subjects in the study?
Yeah, so we're, so in terms of, sorry, do you mean maybe how can we predict he'll have good or poor healing at that time, at follow-up?
Yeah, what, because you said you've altered your criteria slightly based on, you know, looking back on the subjects who did better, who did worse. So what would be like an ideal candidate?
Yeah, so firstly, so I work with our team, the cross bracing protocol team. I'm sort of the head researcher, if you will, and I'm working with the clinicians, so Tom, the sports physician who's really treated all these people in clinical practice. So we approach it from slightly different angles. So some of the changes that occurred in clinical practice, we don't really have the research to support, you know. So if you ask me, I'd say we're designing a prognostic study at the moment to identify and to answer that question, to look at the predictors of healing and better grades of healing. But based on sort of Tom's intuition and his experience, he has changed now over time who he it's not that he selects, it's that he'll sort of sit them down and says, look, I reckon you have a pretty small chance of having a grade one heal, meaning they're more likely to achieve a grade two heal based on what he's seen. And because of that, in some cases, he recommends surgery. But then I sort of say, oh, well, hang on, we don't know that yet. And also we don't know, a grade two is not necessarily a poor outcome, because for some of those people, their knee will function really well. And we need to keep in mind that everyone still has the option of having reconstruction after trying this first, but they'll never have the option of healing naturally once you have a reconstruction. Anyway, sorry, I'm getting off topic. So to answer your question, some of the things that we're seeing that we're going to explore through research is, it's more about the nature of ACL rupture that you're seeing on baseline MRI. So whether there's a partial avulsion at the femoral origin. That's the main factor. If you look at the patient characteristics table in the BJSM paper, you'll see the percentages that had that grade one heal with a partial avulsion are much smaller than the percentage that had the grade two or a worse heal. Okay. So potentially, I think it was in the range of, you know, maybe 82% compared to 8%. So potentially that could be pretty important, and it sort of makes sense, right? So if it's ripped off the bone, then the fibers are less likely to come back together and bridge it, et cetera. So that's likely going to be relevant. The other things that could be is the degree of disruption of fibers. So sometimes on baseline MRI, the distal portion of ACL is flipped, or it's sitting really outside of the intercondylar notch. So for those people, the fibers may be less likely to, you know, stand up straight and realign and find its other half, if you will. The gap distance. So in some cases, you'll see a large gap between the two ruptured ends of the ACL. In other cases, the gap distance is smaller. Mm-hmm. So a larger gap distance could be less likely to have an optimal heal. And we think the timing at which you begin the brace, so there's likely a window of opportunity, you know, post-ACL rupture. So if you wait in some cases 2 or 3 weeks or even longer, it may be too late to kind of utilize that window of opportunity where there's still inflammation in the knee. And in some of those cases, we see the ACL retract and the end of the ACL is rounded over, so it's sort of involuted. And in those cases, it may be too late for that to go on and experience healing. Mm. All speculative at this stage, because we need to do the, you know, the analysis to back it up, but there's some of the factors we'll be exploring.
There's similarities there with Achilles, isn't there? Achilles tendon, I think, with the way, with in terms of the gap and the position and the timing and stuff like that. It does, yeah, it makes a lot of sense logically what you're saying. It's fascinating, isn't it, really?
I think so. We've had some criticism, but a bit of social media, Twitter, people saying, I don't think we should use the word healing. How do we know, you know, what it is we're seeing is not healing? Like, such a buzzword. And I'll sort of flip that on its head and say, if it's any other ligament or tendon in the body, and here it's ruptured it in two pieces and here it's in one piece, there's no hesitancy using the word healing, but for some reason, because it's the ACL, it's all, hold on, you know, we can't call it healing. It must be something else going on here. So it's just a bit funny, I think. But
yeah, I guess from what you just said as well, it kind of shows the importance really of potentially of early scanning as well, like especially in the UK, and me and Glenn were talking about it before you came on, Steph, about the waiting times in the NHS and just how we've had some friends that have had pretty terrible experiences with, like, you know, or not just waiting lists, but consultants unwilling to do stuff about things, who, you know, injuries that people have had, etc. And so I guess that it becomes even more important that if you think someone's got an ACL rupture, in terms of management of that, even with conservative management, actually getting it diagnosed pretty soon and quickly is really important.
Yep, absolutely. And we're lucky in Australia, there's a lot of things we haven't done right in terms of the healthcare system, but one thing that they fund for people so that they don't have to pay out of pocket is an MRI if you either have a suspected ACL or meniscal tear. And that's because there's clear evidence showing that, you know, misdiagnosis or delayed diagnosis could have really negative outcomes with someone's joint health. So that's one thing that you can get funded and it's accessible to everyone. And typically you can get one pretty quickly, although not really in regional or rural areas. You know, it requires a level of specialization to diagnose it accurately. If you've got that skill set as a physio or a sports doctor, you certainly can, but not in all cases. But I think the average clinician maybe doesn't or can't necessarily accurately diagnose it without imaging. And a misdiagnosis could mean someone returns to the sporting field and their knee gives way because, you know, they thought they just had a whatever they've been diagnosed with, and in fact it was an ACL rupture. And what we don't want is episodes giving way because that can cause further knee damage. So I do think it's important. From what we've seen, it may end up being really important for this bracing pathway if it takes off in the future, because it may help around treatment decision making. It could be that certain presentations are best suited to surgery, and by MRI we can help to decipher who will benefit most from surgery or who will benefit from a non-operative treatment route.
Yeah. And are there, from what you've seen from this study, are there candidates who you think don't do well with this protocol, or you think, okay, because I noticed obviously in the study there's not really patients with concomitant injuries, so, you know, obviously meniscal tears and other things going on, it's mainly just a ACL isolated injury, or is that not the case?
No, that's not the case. So there was a lot of concomitant injuries. I think over 50% had a meniscal injury. Rates of MCL rupture were really high as well. So there was a lot of concomitant injuries in this group. One of the interesting findings was that for all but one person, the meniscal injuries became asymptomatic after the brace. And a lot of these meniscal injuries normally would have been surgically operated on had they've had surgery, which sort of makes sense. You know, again, you're giving the meniscus a chance to heal at the same time by immobilization, et cetera. So, yeah, that wasn't the case. It may be that those with a MCL rupture are more likely to have a stiff knee at the point of coming out of the brace. And so for the people that had a stiff knee when the brace came off, that resolved for everyone within 1 to 2 weeks of physio. So none of them had long-lasting range of motion or deficits or knee stiffness. But, yeah, it could be for those people maybe modifying slightly maybe the way to go in the future. You know, there's lots of variations that can be explored with future research, including, you know, the timeline around the brace. Does it need to be at 90 degrees? Could it be at a different flexion angle? Could it be some motion allowed in the brace earlier on? You know, so all of those would require individual studies to explore the different variations, but there's a lot of different potential there.
Yeah, definitely.
One question I had, Steph, in terms of like returning someone to sport. So, you know, with a reconstructed knee, there's this idea that, you know, 9 months is the kind of minimum time for the graft to reach an adequate strength to, you know, sustain those kind of loads. Is there a time frame on like returning someone to sport, or is it all completely criteria based because it's been a natural healing process? Is it longer? Is it around about the same mark? Is there like a set criteria on returning someone to Aussie rules, for example, or soccer or football?
I just want to take a quick break in the podcast to thank our sponsors, Compex. Compex is a company that produce exceptional injury recovery tools. Our favourite, myself and Glenn, is the electrical stimulation machine. And both Glenn and myself use Compex with rehab patients, particularly post-op patients, to speed up recovery, increase muscle strength, and help with pain as well post-op. If you'd like to check out the units or any other rehab tools from Compex, simply go across to www.compex.com and use the promo code HSPhysio for 20% off any products that you buy from them. Now back to the show.
Yeah. So I think because there's clear knowledge gaps around the ligamentization process and the timeline, just as there is knowledge gaps around the graft healing and the timeline. If you're going purely by a criteria-driven approach, even post-ACL reconstruction, some people may tick those boxes at 6 months post-surgery. But then it's sort of saying, hold on, there's another factor here to consider, which is what's happening to the actual graft. Because it's been shown that, you know, up to 2 years post-surgery, the graft is still undergoing, you know, ligamentization and other signs where it's strengthening over time. And it's likely that, likely the case as well with the natural healing, but we don't know the timeline yet. Mm. So we'd err on the side of caution, you know, and like to wait at least 9 to 12 months, even if symptom and function and strength-wise someone's ready at 4 to 6 months. We just want to be cautious, you know, until we have more information to inform that. And yeah, we did see some re-ruptures from the first 80. Those that had a grade one heal at 3 months, and re-ruptured did so either during contact injuries, so like a rugby tackle, for example, or with high-velocity accidents, like a high-velocity skiing accident or someone fell off their bike. Whereas those with a grade two injury, yes, they all injured playing return to sport as well, but they weren't necessarily as high-velocity or always contact. But for some of those people, they'd returned fairly early as well, so it's hard to know, you know, you just don't know yet in terms of the integrity and the length at which it continues to potentially strengthen and return to its maybe tensile properties.
How did the re-rupture rate compare to surgically repaired ACL?
It was fairly low, but we don't have the long-term data yet, so we need longer term data. So for some of these people, they'd only reached 12 months, and for one of the first brace they'd reached 7 years, so there's a bit of a range of data there. But we need to follow them up, you know, into at least a couple of years post-injury, but everyone's a couple of years out, to understand that a bit in a bit more detail.
And when you say one of them went back early, were they given a hard, like, oh, don't go back to sport before 9 months or 12 months, or were they allowed to make that decision based on...
No, a couple did against their physio's recommendations, actually. But the other thing with comparing these re-injury rates, like if we're seeing 92% return to competitive sport, we're going to see more re-injuries than if, say, we're seeing 50% return to sport, because we know that's
exposure, right?
Risk factor. Mm. Absolutely. Yeah, so it's going to be more complicated trying to kind of compare that, which brings me to our next study that we're working on, which is a randomized controlled trial, which will help to solve some of these issues, because we're going to randomize people to ACL reconstruction compared to the cross-bracing protocol. So that's the kind of design you really need to compare things like re-injury rates over time.
And
is there any, me and Glenn were talking about earlier about like delayed treatments and stuff. Is there any kind of negative, I guess, to delaying ACL reconstruction in your view? Because obviously some people in the Canoon trial had delayed ACL reconstruction. Is there any evidence on kind of like worse outcomes from delaying over a certain period of time, for example?
No. So what the Canoon trial found was that there was no difference between those who had delayed surgery and those randomized to early surgery. So that includes 2 year, 5 year, and now 11 year data.
How delayed was that in terms of the delayed?
Well, there's a variation. For most of those, it was within 12 months of injury.
Okay.
Often the criteria typically for crossing over to delayed surgery is if you have an unstable knee, or you don't achieve sufficient knee function despite progressing through that rehab. And it's typically at around 3 months that you can start to see that, but for some people it may be later. So, I mean, as long as your care is properly supervised, I think the danger is we want to avoid gross episodes of giving way, and we especially want to avoid repetitive episodes of giving way. So physios need to be cautious in that they're supervising the rate of progression, and they can pick up any signs, hey, this knee actually is unstable despite sufficient muscle function, and this person is a really good candidate for surgery. So I wouldn't say what we don't want to happen is, you know, maybe someone tries rehab, they're not really participating in physio, they're running around on an unstable knee that hasn't been picked up, and because of that, they've damaged their meniscus and other knee structures. But yeah, on average, there's no difference in outcomes. Obviously, there's some benefit in prehabilitation as well, which can improve postoperative outcomes. So really, the main downside of trying rehab only is potentially delaying your entire recovery time by around 3 months, you know, if that's when the decision's made, or it could be longer. Then the upside to that is you have a chance of avoiding surgery completely and potentially returning to sport and recovering faster. So there's pros and cons, and it isn't kind of clear cut in terms of weighing that up. In professional sport, sometimes, you know, I think they appreciate the certainty and they're like, well, we can't afford to play with 3 months. We'd rather know a clear timeline of at likely 12 months post-surgery, this person's ready. But for the average, you know, athlete or sport participant, that 3 months, you know, and potentially avoiding surgery is, you know, a choice which in most cases, in a lot of cases, is a suitable one.
I think the prehab's undervalued as well, you know, so even if they end up having surgery, that 3 month period where they've been strengthening their knee up, it makes their recovery quicker, doesn't it, after the surgery anyway. So I think it's often a win-win. And I mean, certainly in the UK, they're waiting that long anyway, minimum, before they will get reconstruction on the NHS. In fact, that would be remarkably quick. So
and the 3 month time point is also interesting because it seems to be the point at which we can already see on MRI who's likely to heal and who isn't. So that's interesting, right? I know we're not encouraging everyone to go out and get a million MRIs, but if we did have that available after trying rehab and then looking at the status of the ACL at 3 months, that may be able to inform then in a safe way who's most likely to benefit from surgery or continue on with rehab.
Yeah, and no, I think that's a really fascinating point as well, is like who it would appeal to. You know, it seems like there's a big section of people that are really, it would appeal to them to avoid the surgery. Whereas like we were talking before we started broadcasting, we've all had ACL reconstructions. It sounds like we've had like differing kind of experiences of them. But in my head, when I first read it, I thought, oh, 12 weeks. But obviously there's that graded increase of range after 4 weeks. But in my head, I was thinking, oh, 12 weeks I was running, you know, so after the reconstruction. But then the more we discuss it, I think you look back with rose tinted spectacles. I was in quite a lot of pain after the surgery for a while. I think I had 3 weeks off work. I had a meniscal repair as well, so my knee was pretty sore. So yeah, if I discount the pain and think, oh, 12 weeks I was running. But yeah, it's really interesting that some people would think, because the surgery's tried and tested to a degree, right? If I put in the time and I put in the effort and I put in the rehab, I'm, in my head, I always thought I'd have a good outcome. I don't know if I was deluded, but with the cross bracing protocol, because it's new, because it seems challenging in that first 4 weeks, I'm just intrigued over who does it really appeal to? Who does it really, because it seems like there's a big section that are really adamant they don't want surgery, right? Particularly if they've had a previous ACL experience that maybe hasn't gone particularly well.
It seems almost to me as well like a bit of a no-brainer, in the sense of if there's no there's no evidence that delayed surgery is worse for you, then what if I think it's going to come down for a lot of patients around that first 4 weeks, and can they do that? Like, some people might be working in an environment where, you know, they might be working, they might not be able to take time off, they might not be, you know, there might be certain things where they think, I just can't do that. But I think for a lot of people, if you've got the ability to have that time off, or to just, you know, or if, you know, office workers working from home, etc., they're not professional athletes, I think it would massively, it makes to me, it's a bit of a no-brainer, because you've got that time then to see how it responds. And there's not really any, doesn't really seem to be any downsides other than the inconvenience of that first few weeks. But like you were saying earlier, Steph, it's kind of inconvenient having the op anyway.
Yeah, and if the inconvenience is too much, there's rehab only, where 1 in 3 are going to heal, and then you don't have the inconvenience of the brace. So the chance of healing may be lower, but so is the inconvenience around that. So that may be.
But 90% is huge, isn't it? 95% is going up to. That's a massive number, isn't it? So if someone was giving me that data, you know, well, we're showing a 90% plus chance of healing with this protocol, then it suddenly becomes a bit more appealing, doesn't it? It's kind of like, okay, well, that's as high as a return to sport rate for like a professional athlete, isn't it? You know, so I mean, the figure that was given to me at my age, I was told I had a 30% chance of return to my sport at my age, because I was 38, recreational athlete, and I had a meniscal repair at the same time. So that was a pretty grim stat that I kind of came across.
You held on to, and you remembered that one. I'm sure there's no evidence to back that up. I have no idea where that one came from. We're developing a patient decision aid so that patients can make informed decisions around reconstruction or rehab. And the reason why that's needed is we did an Australia-wide survey. Basically what we found was that what patients are told by clinicians doesn't reflect the evidence. It's maybe not that surprising. Over 90% of surgeons told patients that surgery has better outcomes than rehab alone, and that it's needed if you want to return to sport. And physios also told that to patients. Around 64% of physios told patients that advice. So if you look at the research, there's actually no difference in return to sport rates, and no difference in outcomes between the two treatment strategies. But that's not passed on to the patients. So the evidence they're receiving and their knowledge doesn't reflect what the research shows, and therefore they can't make an informed decision. And I think probably the advice given is likely quite similar on average in the UK. It's fairly widespread. It may be a bit better in Scandinavia. They seem to be quite good with these things in terms of incorporating evidence into practice. But, yeah, so I think that's an issue as well. And when it comes to reconstruction, if we say, you know, people have a preference for it, or a lot of people choose that, that's fine. But the information they're receiving that informs that decision needs to be accurate, and it shouldn't be biased. And they should also be receiving information about the potential surgical complications and harms, which we know is an issue, but it's often what we found in Australia. A few patients are aware or informed about that before having surgery. Another interesting finding from the cross-bracing protocol was that a couple of people that had re-ruptured their ACL after it healed said, I don't want to have surgery, I want to go through the brace a second time. And those people actually had a grade one heal a second time. So it suggests ACLs may be able to rupture and heal and rupture and heal more than once, which makes sense because other tissues in the body can do that. But with ACL reconstruction, once you rupture your graft, your chances of having a very poor outcome are really high. So there's a lot of evidence showing that in terms of osteoarthritis, knee pain, inactivity. So you're in a pretty bad situation if you're one of those people that will rupture your graft. And that's fairly common. You know, if you're a young female playing soccer, it's like 1 in 4. In some cases, 1 in 3 with young active people. So are people aware of that when making the treatment decision? Typically not. It's not until they get to that situation, go and see their surgeon again, and then some people are told, oh, you should give up sport, or you won't be able to, you know, run around with your kids in the future. And they're sort of like, well, I didn't realise, you know, this was a risk for me until I'm actually here. So they're considerations as well when weighing up treatment options. There's lots of pros and cons, but we need more information about this bracing pathway so we can fill in some of the longer term gaps. You know, potentially if we can heal the ACL naturally, it may reduce the rate of osteoarthritis in the future. We don't know yet, but kind of makes sense, right? Like if we can return the knee function to normal and avoid the trauma of surgery to the joint, possibly it could have some positive long-term impacts as well.
You mentioned those young females. That was a question I wanted to ask about, because I have quite a few in my practice. I work in a gym environment, and so I work near a local hospital that does ACLs. So I see quite a few ACLs, particularly young female footballers. And it seems as though surgeons, certainly where I work, are very much like you said, Steph. They will pretty much tell young female footballers to have it done, to have this ACL. And it seems like, so I don't know, did you have any sort of pediatric patients within your studies, and what's your view on that? Because it seems like pediatric girls in particular, they seem to push down the ACL reconstruction route faster even than conservative management, even like for adults, for example.
I'm not sure why, because they actually have poor outcomes. So the poorest group, they do the worst with ACL reconstruction is young females taking part in soccer, for example. So that we know is that they represent people who are at risk of poor outcomes with surgery. Yes, we had pediatric kids, like the youngest was 11, that's done the bracing protocol. So even within that first 80, there's a number of people aged under 18 years. And now with around 400 treated, there's a larger proportion. And, yeah, they've had positive outcomes, certainly no worse than, you know, the adults undergoing the bracing protocol. You know, I think it's hard for physio. I don't blame physios for not quite understanding the complexities of the literature in this area, because it is so complex. And we have, you know, consensus statements out there telling us one thing, maybe largely informed by a surgeon's expert opinion, telling us that ACL surgery is the best option if you want to return to sport. And then we have another consensus statement that's informed by literature review saying that in most cases, rehab first is the best option before considering surgery. So you've got conflicting consensus statements. You've got conflicting conclusions of papers. So we can't expect busy clinicians to have the time or the skill sets to critically appraise the literature to understand what they should believe and what they shouldn't. So this is another reason for this patient decision aid. You know, I think if we can help, you know, inform both physios and patients and in a way that they can digest the evidence in a balanced, unbiased way, I think that's really needed, because it is complicated when it comes to ACL surgery and ACL management in general.
Yeah, and regardless, the rehab is key as well, right? It's like when you're dealing with elite athletes, they will train once, twice a day, 5-6 days a week. When you're dealing with a recreational, you know, Sunday league football player who maybe never went to the gym ever before, and then you're trying to convince him to get in the gym 4 times a week for a year. And if they're not willing to participate in that, I think, I mean, we had Ender King on, he had a great line, like, is the juice worth the squeeze? You have to kind of speak to these guys with that kind of mindset. If they're not willing to put the time in, whether they have the surgery or not, they're probably not going to do very well, right? Whereas if you're comparing them to a Chelsea footballer that's got an S&C coach and a physio and he's in the gym every day for 9 months, twice a day sometimes, then you can't compare like for like, right? He's a better athlete before the injury anyway. So yeah, I think that often gets missed as well, like the amount of time that they have to put in, like, regardless.
And I think the rehab as well, the type of rehab people have as well has a massive difference, doesn't it? Like you look at the research around strength deficits after rehab of ACL reconstructions or just conservative, look at their plyometric tests, you look at, you know, things like rate of force development and all those sorts of things, where lots of patients will show big discrepancies after a year, 18 months of having these things done, showing that their rehab probably hasn't been very good or as effective as it maybe could have been if they'd been doing things where they are looking much more objectively at strength markers, at rate of force development, power. So a lot of people, I don't think they get given the squats and the lunges, but they don't really get given specific markers to hit in terms of criteria-based return to sport with regards to things like rate of force development, how much power have they got, have they got that ability to load well, etc. So I think the type of rehab people have, and that's where the elite sports people tend to do, I think, tend to do better. And I think the, from what I understand, the rates of return to sport are much higher in competitive sports. I think probably both because of the motivation, but also because of the quality of rehab that they'll go through as well.
Yeah, the rates of return to sport are likely higher, but the length of their careers are reduced significantly if they've had ACL surgery. And we don't have a lot of data around performance metrics either after returning to sport. But yeah, I absolutely agree that it is really important. I think for some people post ACL reconstruction, it's actually really challenging to achieve those criteria, right? Like to get that extra bit of strength, say quad strength up to 90%, can be really hard in some cases, especially if there's persistent effusion or muscle wasting, which we often see. And there's more factors at play than just sufficient rehab. In some cases, it's certainly super important to give them the best chance of getting there. But some people won't get there and won't reach those markers despite being diligent and having a great physio as well, which I think should be a realistic expectation for some people.
Yeah, because the other thing with the ACL is it's not just a bit of string holding the knee together, right? It's kind of richly innervated with proprioceptive fibers and stuff like that. And even now, I don't even know how many years I am now, 3 or 4 years. But I'm about to go away for 3-4 weeks. And I notice every time I have a long break from training, strength and conditioning, my left knee, which is my operated knee, will get weaker quicker than my right. And that's just the way it is, you know. And then I get back and I've got a strength deficit again that I have to build up. And that's a very strange, that seems to be kind of some people it seems to be quite pronounced on, and some people it doesn't. And certainly for me, I notice a deterioration on my left knee in terms of strength and performance way quicker than the other side if I have a break from training. So that's quite worrying if you suddenly, you know, for work reasons or life or whatever, you stop training and doing your S&C for a few months and you still play your sport. That's always something that's in my mind as well.
Yeah, I read some interesting stuff by Bart Dingenen on as well on sensorimotor training. So just how important not just the strength, but also the sensorimotor system is in terms of, you know, how the brain responds to things, how, you know, so he in his rehab does quite a lot of stuff where he'll do, there's a few apps, I can't remember the name of them now, but there's a few apps on phones that you can use where you'll be landing. This is obviously late stage rehab, but you'll be landing and then it will, you know, have a different direction for you to turn. So you're jumping in the air and then it's telling you which way you need to jump to your directional hop as you're in the air. So you're kind of, your brain's having to process information as you're then doing physical tasks, basically. So he talks a lot about how that is quite an important factor in terms of returning to sport as well. So it's not just about strength, it's also about returning that sensorimotor system and also the psychology as well. We haven't really talked about that, but obviously we know that the scores, don't we, with psychological readiness to return to sport and things of that nature. If you are more confident with your knee, you could, that seems to be better outcomes. And now I think some of that comes from obviously your rehab and what you've had done, etc., and your previous experiences and all those sorts of things. But yeah, that psychological readiness to return to sport is also massive, isn't it, in terms of, you know, outcomes.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, like fear of re-injury, which overlaps with psychological readiness to return to sport. We know fear of re-injury is the number one reason people don't return to sport after ACL surgery. We know that, you know, those with fear of re-injury are less likely to return to sport, but they're also more likely to re-injure themselves or have a poor outcome if they do return to sport. So should we be, you know, trying to get rid of that fear of re-injury, or is it actually a rational response because it's an actual realistic fear that reflects, you know, a realistic risk of returning to sport and re-injuring the knee? It's something interesting to think about, but maybe a protective mechanism that we should be listening to more often, you know.
Yeah, I guess it comes
for some people. Yeah, sorry. For some people, we found like adapting to a lower risk physical activity, you know, in the ideal world, is the best option for health outcomes and knee health outcomes. For some people, that will be at a sacrifice for their quality of life. So for those individuals, that's what we need to weigh up. How important is it to you to return to this sport? Or do you actually enjoy just as much, I don't know, cycling, rowing, whatever it may be, dropping back at a recreation level instead of an elite, or in some way reducing that risk of re-injury? So it's a conversation we need to have as physios to inform people of the risks of returning to, you know, high-level cutting, pivoting sports.
I was also just in my mind, when you talk about that high-risk group of the young female soccer players, football players, we had a surgeon on, a guy called Paul Tricker, who does lateral tenodesis, which he was saying reduces that injury rate by 50%. That sort of procedure is less invasive. I'd be surprised if that has the same links with, you know, increasing degeneration in the joint and stuff. But I wonder if that could be something that could be combined with the cross-bracing protocol as well. So you get the ACL healing through the protocol and then the increased stability through the lateral tenodesis in that particular like subgroup. I was just thinking that in my mind that might be quite a nice combo.
Yeah, I mean, it's an area where the current practice in orthopedics has moved along faster than the evidence base to support it. So I don't think there's robust evidence to support it yet, but people are performing it already as standard practice in clinical practice. But like you say, it's extra capsular, right? So we know that, you know, some of the changes that happen within the knee joint are much greater if you have surgery compared to non-surgery. So that includes the inflammatory response, which persists, and then cartilage breakdown or degradation over time, which may explain the higher rates of OA. But we don't really understand what is it about surgery that's driving those changes, you know, and could it have something to do with disruption to the synovial membrane, actually drilling into the bone and essentially fracturing the bone, putting metal. Like, we don't know which components of the surgery may be causing or contributing to that cascade. And as you say, perhaps the lateral tendinitis is extracapsular and is causing less trauma to the joint. It's possible, speculative, but maybe, yeah, it could be, yeah, interesting.
Is that your thought? What's your thought process, Stefan, why? So I guess the question about with the cross bracing versus surgery, again, it's to me, for a lot of people, seems like a no-brainer to do the cross bracing protocol first, or certainly conservative management at the very least. But if you can do that first 4 weeks of immobilization, or, you know, relative immobilization, then definitely that, you know, the rate of healing in terms of that plus 90% seems amazing. So it just seems such a no-brainer. What's your view on sort of people that maybe wouldn't do well with it, or is it, you know, to me it almost seems like just do it and then see if your knee's stable. If your knee's stable and the function you're doing well, then great. Like, surely that, you know, for most people that would be the case. But is there anyone early on, based on those MRI findings you said earlier, that you would be strongly suggesting, okay, we do think you need an ACL reconstruction, for example?
So firstly, if there's some sort of injury that would necessitate surgery. So we're still fairly cautious with, you know, a bucket handle meniscal tear with mechanical locking. I think most people agree to refer to a surgeon in that case. So with someone with that, you're not going to, you know, they're probably going to do the ACL reconstruction at the same time, although they may not need to. If there's some sort of fracture or something else going on in the knee that necessitates surgical referral, that's a different pathway. It's really important not to just whack a brace on people with an acute ACL rupture. So you need to consider the DVT risk. It's really important. So everyone in the cross-bracing protocols received DVT prophylactics, so medication to reduce the risk of DVT. In the earlier stages, that's, again, adapted in clinical practice to just screening and those with a high risk, sorry, in terms of ultrasound. So initially they'd received an ultrasound to rule out a current DVT before bracing, but then that was dropped and just replaced with the prophylactic medication. But there I'd say exercise caution, because we don't want to be causing DVTs, which can be fatal because people are just immobilized without taking that into consideration. So that's outlined, I hope, really clearly in the paper, but just to reiterate the importance of that. So, yeah, they need to be able to handle that period of mobilization within their lifestyle, obviously. Some people with caring responsibilities, those who can't take time off work. In some of those cases, they've received some adapted protocols, some of which have experienced a good heal with less bracing or some increased movement or less than 4 weeks at 90 degrees. In terms of the nature of injury, if you have a full femoral avulsion, safe to say I wouldn't be bracing those people, even a partial avulsion. It's not everyone. So we've had some partial avulsions that have had excellent heals. So it's not a sure sort of thing, but it's likely less likely if you've got that partial avulsion. So some of those factors I talked about before, you know, they may be kind of accumulative. So if you've got partial avulsion and the distal portion of the ACL is flipped and sitting outside and there's a big gap distance, so maybe putting those together, we don't have the data yet, but they may be less, you know, less suitable for this bracing treatment. Maybe. But, you know, you form them of that and they may still be willing to, you know, what, so there's a small chance that it'll have a heal. They may still want to go down that pathway before opting for surgery. So that's always an option as well.
Amazing. And then just lastly for me, in terms of your future research, you mentioned earlier that there's some gaps, there's some things that we want to find out. So what are the things that you're kind of excited about in terms of doing and researching and kind of what's the next stage really?
So I mentioned a clinical trial comparing ACL reconstruction with the bracing protocol. Mm-hmm. So the primary outcome around that one's patient reported outcomes at 18 months. But we're also planning a trial, you guys can relate to this in the NHS, similar in our public health system, people sit on a wait list in some cases for 18 months doing nothing, waiting for ACL surgery. So we think that's a really good opportunity to do a trial where we can randomize half of those people to the cross bracing protocol and the others are having usual care. So the primary outcome in that case can be the number needing surgery. You'd expect it to be substantially less if they undergo the bracing protocol. But it will also allow us to compare the rate of healing in a treatment group that's been braced and hasn't been braced, which we won't be able to do with the trial of surgery versus the brace protocol. So we'd like to do those two trials. As I mentioned, we're looking at the data in people that have had surgery on the other knee, which I think is really exciting. We're performing a prognostic modelling study so we can try to predict, if you will, based on baseline MRI and patient characteristic, who's most likely to have a grade one heel. So we're designing that at the moment. And then we've got the data from now 400 patients. So we're replicating what we've done with the first 80, but with a larger number of people as well. So that's some of the studies we have ongoing at the moment.
Plenty to keep you busy then.
Mm. Yeah, you could say that, yeah.
And so those things over the next, well, hopefully over the next few years, there'll be things that will be coming out. Because I think those studies you mentioned, particularly the randomized controlled versus, and also the waiting list one, sounds absolutely fascinating. That'd be great to know when they come out.
Yeah, thanks.
Yep. Glenn, do you have any other questions?
No, I think covered everything that I had in my mind. I've really enjoyed it, Steph. Actually, thank you so much for giving us your time.
Thank you both. I always enjoy talking ACL injury management. I could probably talk all day actually about it, so that's good. Thanks for the invite.
Yeah, no, we didn't talk about our own ACL experiences. Maybe we'll have to get you on in the future to chat about it. I think obviously the experience of having an ACL and going through the rehab and all those sorts of things is a fascinating chat, but we could probably chat on for another half an hour, so I won't open that can of worms just now, but yeah, maybe one for the future. But yeah, as Glenn said, Steph, thank you very much for coming on.
Hopefully you guys enjoyed that. If you did, please go over to iTunes and give us a 5-star review and leave a few comments. It really helps us improve the show, and it really helps the show get out to more physios and fitness enthusiasts out there who want to listen to the content, and enables us to get more guests on the show. So I would really, really love it if you could do that. It really helps me and Glenn out, and I will see you on the next one.